Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code SPOTIFY to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code SPOTIFY at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code SPOTIFY.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Okay, so welcome to the New Books in Japanese Studies, the channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Anse Wagenberg. I'm a historian of Japan and Penn State at Kyushu University. Today, I'll be talking to Paul Barclay about his book, Kondo the Barbarian, a Japanese adventure and indigenous Taiwan's bloodiest uprising, which came out with Eastridge Books last year, 2023. I learned much from Paul Barclay's work on Japanese Empire in Taiwan, Japanese military history and Taiwanese indigenous studies, and many other topics in Japanese modern history. Actually, I'm teaching this year and last year also, taught two articles of him on fascism in Manchuria and Japan, never-ending series of small wars before World War II. So I'm very thrilled to have him here today and to talk about his new book. Paul, welcome. You don't have to call me Paul.
Well, thank you very much, Ron, for having me on the podcast. And I think that I should tell listeners that I have put the PDF version of this book online. So if they want to read it and don't want to pay for it, that's fine. It's available open access. And so I'll lead with that in case something that I say interests you.
So, Paul, can you tell us a little bit? And by the way, I took advantage of this for my students. Can you tell us first what brought you to this story and also what brought you to studying Japan to begin with? Tell us a little bit about your background.
Yes. Well, this particular story grew out of my research for a book called Outcasts of Empire, Japanese Rule on Taiwan's Savage Border, which is a larger view of Japanese imperialism in Taiwan. And I came across a 29-part serialized memoir of the life of an interpreter, and it was published in a newspaper. So the things that brought me to this story are very specific to the research process, and I can circle back to that. But to zoom out, I got interested in Japanese history by studying U.S. imperialism in the Philippines as an undergraduate, and I became interested in a regional complex of colonial empires and their interactions with hill peoples and minority groups. And I added Japanese history to the things I was working on actually as a grad student. So I came to this secondarily after being interested in U.S. history, but having taught the English language in Japan between undergrad and graduate school, it wasn't an abrupt transition into Japanese history. So I had some Japan background. So it's an interest in comparative history, an interest in empire, life experience that brought me to the University of Minnesota at first to work on the empire in Taiwan.
Yeah, when comparative, actually, it's a big theme, at least for me, when I read this book. You open the book examining, and you actually said, coming two legendary figures in this book. One is, of course, Kondo Katsubaro, the barbarian, the Japanese colonist you write about, who spent most of his life living among the indigenous people. And Mona Rudau, that's how you say it? How you pronounce it? Mona Rudau, who claimed Kondakran to be his son-in-law and intimate with, and he was, of course, the leader of the famous Musha Uprising, which I'll ask you if you can tell a little bit more about. Both are bigger than life. One of them, Mona Rudau, was the hero of a relatively recent film, Warriors of the Rainbow. And in the book, you write that you find them, again, a comparative thing, you find Mona Rudau similar to other tragic heroes like William Wallace. We can think about, Sitting Bull and other tragic indigenous figures. And for Kondo, I was thinking of similar people like, you know, Dancing with Wolves types in American colonial experience. So I want to ask you, in what ways do you think this politics of memory, the cultural imagery of the Western colonial experience is responsible for understanding of those two figures, right? This is the Japanese and indigenous Taiwanese, yet we use other frames, I feel, to refer to them.
So this is a great question, and it has a two-part answer. I mean, the short answer is I'm trying to communicate to undergraduates and general readers in an English language context. So the sort of Braveheart or that Hollywood film, The Last Samurai, there's different reference points that I thought could draw a reader in. And so some of that imposition of the so-called Western imaginary is just, for me, a literary device to make this history accessible to people who would be reading in English. But I think there's a deeper answer to this that causes us to reflect upon our kind of global 20th century, is that as Japanese actors at this time, like Kondo and his readers, imagined indigenous peoples and themselves as embodiments of Bushido or samurai ethos, they were participating in a Japanese form of memory politics. But that Bushido discourse, as we know from Oleg Benesch's book and from Bob Tierney's work on Tropics of Savagery, was itself part of a Japanese encounter with global currents in chivalry and primitivism. So I think when we move into the 1930s, it's already pretty hard to disentangle what is an East Asian way versus a Western way of kind of packaging one's memory or narrating it, because we are now really in an era of global formations. And so I think that as I think about trying to cast this story from an East Asian lens of consciousness and discourse, I think we need to be acutely aware that by 1930, it's not particularly East Asia in the sense of being non-Western.
Oh, and can you tell us a little bit more about the Musha Uprising and the particular context for the book?
Sure. So on October 27th, 1930, 300 or so Sidik people committed a day of violence against Japanese colonists in the administrative town of Musha, Taiwan, in the center of the island in the mountainous area. Many civilians were killed on a sports day, and some policemen were killed. Ammunitions and rifles were stolen, and that ended up in a 50-day war wherein the Japanese colonial police force, backed by the Imperial Japanese Army, put this uprising down over the course of about 50 days. And so Taiwanese lost about 1,000 lives and had many villages eradicated. There were relocation programs. And then on the Japanese side, there was the horror of this massacre that set the train of events in line. And then the big question is when do you sort of set the timetable and say, when did this begin? Is it something you want to begin on the day of the massacre, or is it connected to a longer train of policies? So basically the Musha incident refers to that violent uprising and its suppression in 1930 in Taiwan.
Yeah, that's the question of chronology is something I want to come back to maybe in one of the later questions. I was thinking a lot. I was reading it as the October 7th events and aftermath in Gaza unfolded. And there's a lot of connections that I made, at least here. But I'll come back to this. I just want to stay in the 1920s, 1930s. When I'm teaching Empire, a lot of time I use a book called Empire Made Me by Richard Tinkler. We talk about a working class Englishman, World War I veteran, who come from almost nothing. He was a coal miner's son, and he went to work in colonial police in China. And the book, in many ways, like Kondo, I think, shows how lower class people from the metropole had a lot of opportunity in Empire. Like, so I want to ask, like, how do figures like Tinkler and Kondo complicate our understanding of Japanese colonists? Because we used to think about, I guess I'm more used to work on Okinawa, is like there's the state, there's colonial state, colonials, and then there's the population. But it seems to me things are a little bit more complicated here.
Well, they are, and I think there's a couple of ways that Kondo's story complicates this understanding about colonialism and colonists. I mean, there are echoes of Jun Uchida's book, Brokers of Empire, wherein we see that the colonial government often will favor particular Taiwanese over particular Japanese, depending on their interest group and location to further policy. So it's not always the case that Kondo has a preference in settling land claims over Taiwanese people, even though he's supposed to be a son of the emperor more so than the people in Taiwan. When we get into the details of a particular sort of working class life in the colony, we find that the hierarchy isn't so neat, that the paths to mobility for Kondo are much more constricted than they are for many Taiwanese people. So there's that, but I think there's also the interesting issue of how a person, an individual who's not situated with much cultural capital or financial capital makes his way in an imperial setting where there's not a lot of structure. And so the mobility complex, the way people find their ways in an empire, they're dynamic and they change depending on the stage of the empire. And he got there in the beginning, and we get to watch the opportunity structures expand and constrain in different areas of land reclamation, working as a trading post operator, an interpreter, a guide. All of these things change as the colony itself changes. And I think we have to look at somebody at that almost individual level to bring that lens to an empire, which, as you said, it often comes down to this kind of binary. There's the colonizer and the colonized, and that doesn't always help us understand how the empire was actually able to function.
And maybe it will help at this point, and I really should have done it in the beginning, but as we're still in kind of early stages, maybe you'd help like to tell us a little bit about Kondo and his life story. We mentioned that he comes from a modest background. Maybe just a little bit about his arc of his life, because he's not really, I definitely saw him as a kind of a loser of this history, even though, of course, indigenous people are the real losers in this history. But even his story is not very, it's not very, how should I put it? It's not very positive, I guess, the way it ends up.
Well, I think that we'll circle back to this issue about winners and losers and indigenous peoples later in the talk. And I think it's an interesting one. Kondo himself was born just 6 years after the Meiji Restoration in 1873 in Tokushima. And he was the son of a dye merchant, somebody who worked in indigo. And Kondo himself worked on a ship in the Sino-Japanese War in logistics. From what fragmentary evidence exists, he was a pretty disobedient person. He had a proclivity to violence and larceny, but he was also a bit of a hustler. And he did come to Taiwan without much, but he did get the patronage of lower level Japanese colonial officials. And it seems to me that his knowledge in textile dyeing and in vegetable dyes and in dry goods, he parlayed that into a career as an operator of an indigenous trading post. So he would buy skins and plants and medicinal items from indigenous peoples, and then he would sell them guns and gunpowder and salt in the early days, and then in later days, finished cotton goods. But he was an adept at languages too. He was very good at language acquisition. And so his background is really what we would call small business, dry goods. And one of these, a lot of these people in this generation of Meiji are taking advantage of this Meiji spirit of self-rising and self-making, even if it's imperfectly understood. It's maybe not in a perfectly meritocratic sense, but he is in that generation, and he does begin relatively disadvantaged. And part of the story of the book is how he tries to accumulate capital and land and respectability in the face of those origins.
Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, his character comes out in the memoir. I mean, he's a show off. He's a show off. You can't. You, so many times you catch him lying. I think the hustler and the violence comes out. I mean, I think didn't he have to? He said he had to swim ashore because he had a fight with the sailors in the, on the ship that brought him to Taiwan, something like this. It's
So there is an
yeah.
account of him in one of these Japanese sort of gossipy books that comes out in the 20s, where they're sort of these strange tales from empire. And apparently Kondo did get from Hong Kong, where he was in the flower business, and he wanted to get to Taiwan, so he rode on an American ship. And I think he was thrown off the ship in Geelong Harbor and swam ashore, at least in the legend of Kondo. I mean, I can imagine different scenarios that are basically like that. I think it was probably a very it was a contentious time in that first wave of Japanese colonists that came to Taiwan. If they weren't coming down from the Liaodong Peninsula as part of the army, these were the kind of people that wash up on shore in an empire throughout the world, getting a second chance. So I think he's an interesting person. It's hard to nail down the details for folks like that.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code SPOTIFY to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code SPOTIFY at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code SPOTIFY.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for craveable, hand-battered, cooked-to-order chicken fingers.
Chicken up.
Crispy, crinkle-cut fries.
Hot potato coming through.
Buttery Texas toast.
Toast walking.
And secret Cane's sauce.
Topping off now.
Turbocharge your chicken fingers and get them even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app.
Go, go, go!
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I was interested in his family background. I mean, he's not a samurai, of course, but he makes a lot of kind of Yamato Damashii, like Japanese spirit. I don't know if it's him or the memoir or his writing in 1930s. I mean, we can talk about it a little bit later. But I do want to talk a little bit about the samurai culture and again, staying with parallels, maybe not to the West and other colonials, but maybe Japan's own history, because you write, and this is something you wrote on. Also, in other contexts about compensation, that and this is about, I think this is following the rebellion. Correct me if I'm wrong. You write that the medals and cups, the Yasukuni enshrinement conferred by Japanese soldiers and policemen for service in Taiwan in 1930s, late 1930s, were commonly employed forms of recognition of military service throughout the world in 1920s, 1930s. Indigenous auxiliaries, on the other hand, were awarded in a manner that harkened back to Japan's feudal past. Cash paid on the spot for severed heads. And memory itself also, at the time, they make the same parallel, right? It's not just your interpretation. They write on headhuntings like it's like something straight out of an ancient Japanese military saga. If they clean the head and set up for display for viewing. And this is, of course, this is how samurai used to get compensated, right? It reminded me of a scene in Mark Rovino's book on Sagio Takamori. I think it's The Last Samurai, where they present Saigo's head to IGH. I also use in teaching because they all dress up in Western military uniform, the images, yet they show the head. And Rovino sees it as somewhat of a paradoxical moment. There's a lot of symbolism about the change in military traditions. And I wonder if there's any kind of play with symbolism here as well, this reference to ancient Japanese past that was kind of fascinating. It's not ancient, it's 1877, right? It's just 50 years before the Mushi Rebellion. So are indigenous people here representing Japan's own past? And what does it mean about Japanese indigenous relationship?
Well, this is an interesting problem about the head. I would enter this through the 1874 invasion of southern Taiwan that was led by Saigo Takamori's younger brother, Tsugumichi. And these troops are from, generally, they're Satsuma people, and they're Kagoshima people, and they come to Taiwan, and the first thing they do on their scouting expedition is they sever heads of Taiwan people, and they're upbraided. The modern Japanese military does not do this, they're told. Well, they didn't seem to know any better. This is 1874, 3 years before Saigo Takamori. And so this issue about, you know, our modern military supposed to take heads as symbols of battlefield prowess, isn't that an early modern or pre-modern thing, and it's not in keeping with a modern military sense of decorum and keeping with professionalism? It's a good question. And I think that in Kondo's case, there's a complicated seeming kind of flood of emotions about this head reverence that ripples down through Japanese oral culture and military culture about displaying the head, but displaying it in different ways as part of battlefield accomplishment. But I think he's also interested in the ritual attention that is being paid to the fallen in a way that is not sort of callous. And so he is witnessing a ceremony that welcomes the vanquished enemy. It ritually incorporates that enemy into the in-group, and he's trying to puzzle through that. But I think, on the other hand, modern militaries always try to distance themselves from being violently oriented, from being essentially violent enterprises. And so, you know, heads do get cut off. People are rewarded in informal ways, and local enemies are turned against each other as a matter of course in warfare. And that happened in Taiwan during Musha, when these indigenous auxiliaries were given cash out of the barreled head for the severed heads of women, children, and adults. Any head would do. There's no precedent for that in The Hague or in the Geneva or modern military science, but it dovetailed with the violence of battlefield activity. So yes, that tension is there, and some of it is the tension between a professionalizing, modernizing military, which is supposed to be driven by kind of honor and military codes and striving for a particular kind of decoration, and the impulse to wanton violence. So I think that I will just stop it there. There's a lot
there's
do
a lot
there.
To unpack. Yeah, there's definitely a lot to unpack. But I want to keep on this point, because maybe just a little bit off script here. There is a repeated reference in a memoir itself to Japanese military past. to Bushido values, to spirits of Japan. So, for example, there is the Captain Fukuhari.
Yes, Fukuhari. Fukuhari is a big part of this. Yes.
Yeah, maybe we can talk a little bit about him in a second. But this captain committed supposedly seppuku. I don't understand. Or he jumped from a cliff, and they said about how the indigenous were so awed by the Japanese spirit and the ritual disemboweled. I don't understand how he both ritual disemboweled and jumped from a cliff at the same time. But there's this tension that I saw, and correct me if I'm wrong, of we're not just, we have our own Japanese thing, this our own fierceness, our own martial spirit, some kind of a kinship that indigenous can appreciate. So some kind of, maybe there's some kind of closeness between indigenous martial culture and Japanese martial culture, or maybe I'm just reading too much into it.
I mean, I think Bob Tierney's book, Tropics of Savagery, does a good job at getting at this point that many Japanese visitors to Taiwan or people that were consuming literature about Taiwan saw a very close alliance between lost masculine samurai virtues and the ones that were still extant in the northern indigenous tribes. So that sort of imagined kinship, as you would add in third layer, would be juxtaposed against sort of effeminate Chinese inhabitants of Taiwan. So we would frame this sort of homology between samurai virtue and indigenous masculinity and think of Chinese people in contradistinction as perhaps more commercially oriented and less masculine. And so there is a deep kind of recapitulation of samurai ethos here in an imagined kinship, but it's refracted through, you know, the Japanese public school curriculum of the early 20th century and the reinvention of Bushido, but also the Furosato theme of the countryside having something that the cities don't. So I think that there is very much in Kondo's narrative an attempt for him to insert himself into a longer arc of warrior tales and Japanese virtue, when in other points in the memoir he's as scared as hell and he's afraid of his own shadow. So he's trying to tell this story of command and of self-confidence in the face of a person that's really outnumbered and often unarmed. So we cannot discount the fact that he is drawing on a deep well of discourse that positions Japanese combatants as manifestations of older military traditions.
Yeah, and there's always this tension between Japanese empire and military, again, technology, like emphasis on technology versus emphasis on spirit and civilizing mission. What does it mean, of course? And within the civilizing of the, you know, pacification and civilizing of the indigenous people, of course, the Japanese drawing, and I'm going to go like drawing on Western, on Western technologies and Western methodologies, technologies of power vis-a-vis the indigenous people. I think about the guard line here and the construction of a guard line. And maybe we can go back a little bit more into the historical story here, right? Because Kondo is operating within a historical trajectory of the subjection of the indigenous people, which was done, and this is where Fukuhara comes in, right? Like maybe we can talk a little bit about the five-year plan campaigns and Fukuhara mission and how the Kondo fit into it, because the rebellion itself is the end point, right? As you said, it depends where we start, right? It's the end point, but Kondo, for example, seems to me, right, he blames the rebellions on the construction of the guard line and to mistreatment of the Siddiq people, right?
Yes, so maybe we can talk about, correct.
Yeah, maybe talk about how the Siddiq people react to the guard line and how does wider Japanese policies kind of, you know, relate to this? And I'm especially interested in you talk about global economic shifts that were part of it. So what's the bigger context here in terms of the rebellion and Kondo story?
Well, I think the best way to put it is to think of Taiwan as a geographical entity that can be roughly divided into mountains and plains. And the mountains have particular kinds of resources that are valuable on a global market. So the Qing Dynasty, which ran Taiwan up until 1895, more or less, they had embarked upon a policy between the government and entrepreneurs to build trenches and fortresses to protect people harvesting timber on indigenous lands. Enter the Japanese. They fortify these pre-existing lines that are started under the Qing, and they bring more modern technology and more capital to bear on this problem, but they also want more resources. They want to produce it industrially. They don't want to just buy it from small entrepreneurs that finish it. They want to put their own factories there. So the scale is going to go up, and that means that the pacification has to be ratcheted up. And so this is where Kondo enters the picture. In 1897, he's supposed to guide this engineering unit, the Fukuhori mission, through the Central Mountains so they can lay railway tracks as part of this infrastructure project to move raw materials out of Taiwan. And the CEDIC people and neighboring people kill all 14 members of this expedition. But Kondo is luckily recuperating from malaria and doesn't get killed. So fast forwarding from 1897 up through 1903, this guard line that's supposed to separate hostile indigenous peoples from industrious camphor merchants who are harvesting timber so they can boil it down into a material that you can make smokeless gunpowder out of or celluloid, very valuable on the world market. The government augments this guard line, like they build it like the Great Wall of China in little pieces, and then it gets linked up. And Kondo's role in all of this is to marry in to different indigenous societies and to win their trust as a trading post operator, as a conduit of weapons and metal, and as an intermediary to organize auxiliary forces to help the Japanese move their heavy guns into the mountains. And this is a process. And so Kondo's involved in this for 6 to 9 years. And that's the heart of the story, is Kondo's sort of position as a broker and a mediator and a wheeler dealer who helps the empire as he helps himself, as he helps certain indigenous peoples, but to the detriment of all of them and ultimately to himself. So that guard line is a central piece. It's basically the moving physical manifestation of the Japanese colonial frontier.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear it was based on Qing policies. I was thinking it came from the British in India. They had similar, used similar tactics in pacifying some parts of India. It's fascinating, this Qing heritage and colonial examples from other places.
I think we have to remember that the people in East Asia on the Japanese Ainu frontier, on the Qing Central Asian frontier, if we think of Yunnan province, East Asians did not need help from Westerners to concoct ways of turning non-agricultural space into highly extractive space. They had centuries of practice regionally before looking to these other empires. And I think that through line is now becoming more apparent in the literature on Qing dynasty statecraft. But anyway, I'll return this to you.
Yeah, no, there's a recent book that tries, maybe we shouldn't get into it, East Asia is non-colonial versus the West is colonial and environmental stuff. Like, maybe just put it aside. Stay with the Qing, but stay maybe with the stay with the Qing, stay with the Chinese actually, and maybe move back, move, stay with Taiwan here. The book is mostly, of course, about Japanese indigenous relationship, but there is a whole bunch of, I mean, there is, for me, the elephant in the room was the Chinese population, right? Because they do make a appearance here and there. It's not a focus of the book, of course. I'm not asking you why you didn't. I mean, we all have to make choices. But maybe we can talk a little bit more about the relationship with the indigenous and the Japanese and how they fit into it.
Well, that's a great question. And I think the term Chinese in this context might be a little bit confusing because in the case of colonized Taiwan, most of the non-indigenous population that lived in proximity to Siddic people were Hakka people. So these are migrants from Guangdong, and they tend to settle in the valleys and plateaus that abut indigenous areas, and they occupy a mediating position between plains-dwelling Holo or Hoklo people from Fujian and Austronesian peoples in the interior. So Hakka people play an important role in this book and in other work I've done and in cinematic portrayals of indigenous Sinophone relations in Taiwan. So that's one important group. So Hakka peoples traded weapons to indigenous peoples, and they exported hides and Chinese medicine ingredients to the plains. And they were an independent-minded group that would maybe be like the Scots-Irish in American history, but mountain people that were not indigenous. Another Sinophone group that is part of this story are the so-called mixed Aborigines. And these are people who wore queues like Qing subjects and spoke Chinese, but they also had indigenous ancestry. And this is where Kondo's story gets started, with the settlements of so-called Jukuban or mixed heritage people who do have some claims to Chineseness and some claims to indigenousness. And they are an occupational group. Their whole reason for existence is either as auxiliary fighters in wars against indigenous peoples, but also as polyglot peoples that can negotiate multilingual borders. And another group of Chinese people that play a large part in this story are landowners with capital that use the Japanese court system and title deed infrastructure to claim title to indigenous lands. And these are Chinese people that Kondo is in competition with to get title to land through this new modern land regime. So there are non-indigenous, non-Japanese people who are important to this story in the book, but they don't really show up as Chinese because they're either Hakka people or they're Jukuban people or they're Chinese entrepreneurs in the plains that have different subject positions vis-a-vis indigenous peoples and vis-a-vis Japanese colonists. So I think it's a complicated story of ethnic diversity that doesn't exactly divide into indigenous Chinese and Japanese, although at some level we have to make those distinctions.
Yeah, and I want to keep a distinction because it's something it's something, again, like going back, I just said before, I mean, a lot of this, when I was reading this book, I mean, everything that happens right now in Israel, Palestine, it was back of my head. There's so many similarities that I could see in terms of also the distinction, you know, who's colonial, who's indigenous, what is the role of violence? Where do you start the story, right? So,
right.
You know, the Mushar Bells, they were brutal, right? It's very, very brutal. I mean, they attacked Sports Day, right? They didn't attack a military installation, killed hundreds of civilians, you know. But then the repression was brutal, was genocidal, right? Repression, the use of gas, bomb, use of poison gas, right? Use of air force, the killing and putting them in concentration camps, the headhunting of children by the auxiliaries. Was there any reaction to Japan in regards to this? You know, because you the brutality of reaction, maybe there's any criticism, because you note that Kondo himself was sympathetic to the grievances of Moshe rebels, and I don't know how he reacted to the actual brutality of the Japanese, but was this any kind of understanding of the rebels or condemnation of the army at the time in Japan, or at all?
There was. I don't think it was widespread. The media coverage is, it begins very, of course, sympathetic to the massacred Japanese, and not much is known about the rebels except they're immediately referred to as savages. So, you know, one of the parallels between the October 7th and the Musha, and the parallels are hard and contentious and emotional, but, you know, the first understanding of people in Japan was that these weren't necessarily soldiers, or this wasn't a war, but this was a conflict between civility and barbarism. That said, as the war against the CEDEC rebels progressed, there was criticism in Japan voiced against the army and the administration, and some of that did shade into some kind of sympathy for the rebels, but the sympathy was, I think, kind of opportunistic. One source of criticism of the government is that the Seiyukai wanted to criticize the Minsaito. It was a Minsaito administration in charge in Tokyo, but Governor General Ishizuka is a Minsaito man. So a lot of the fact-finding and criticism of the Japanese response to the rebellion is just two-party politics. And it shows how two-party politics can matter, because you have two parties contending for power. You expose a lot of things that are going on, even if the reason for the expose is opportunistic. A lot of things that people need to know are exposed in these fact-finding missions. And there are Japanese leftists and Marxists who go to Taiwan and hold up the rebels as champions of proletarian anti-colonial politics, even though they don't know very much about people in Taiwan. There's a symbolic alignment. And I think we see that a lot today in the current situation. You know, why would people hold up one side against the other, not knowing much about conditions on the ground, is that different sides can become symbols of other causes. And that happens here. So the initial Japanese response to the massacre isn't one of sympathy for the CEDEC people, but as the fact-finding missions pile up documents and we move further and further away from the massacre, there is an understanding that the colonial state was exploitative of indigenous labor and that this was a powder keg. But also the inquiries lambasted the government for not protecting settlers. The scandal is that the attack happened at all. And I think there's some resonance here with the attacks on Netanyahu politically for not seeing this coming or heeding advice, which of course happens in Musha. Why didn't you listen to intelligence that said this would happen? So I guess there are a lot of ways that we could use Musha to think about current events, but I think there's some glaring differences. I mean, there's no equivalent to Hamas in central Taiwan. The CEDEC people are not connected to external sources of funding and support in this way that they're never really a threat to Japan in a sense, in any kind of sense. So I think we could find a lot of parallels, but we could find a lot of differences. And this could just turn into a 7-day discussion. So I'll let you respond. So yes, yeah. I'm thinking about it too, and I think it's too soon. The emotions are so raw and things are ongoing, and I don't know enough, but yes, I think the parallels are there. Some of them.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
As we speak, there's an event here in Penn State organized by Tamir Sorek, my colleague, about asking if the war in Gaza is a colonial war. And I can, it's the whole situation on both sides. It's so complex. And the question of it's even the situation on October 7 is colonial. I mean, those settlers are in Taiwan, right? Well, those people in Israel are in what they claim to be their country. And there's a lot going for this claim of both sides being indigenous to an extent. So there's a lot to talk about, but maybe again, we can talk about it the whole day. I want to remain in the present in a way though. Talking about politics of memory. So, we talk in a little bit about the book about this, that interestingly enough, the death of Prime Minister Hamaguchi in Tokyo Station by right-wing assassins almost immediately eclipsed the Mushi Rebellion. And definitely in historical memory, what came afterwards, right? 15 years war, the descent to the dark valley of fascism completely eclipsed the whole Mushi incident and what happened in Taiwan. So I want to talk a little bit about the longer-term relationship indigenous post-war Japanese historical memories because we talk a lot from Japanese side, partly because of my own training in Japan. And I want to talk a little bit about the indigenous historical memory here, but also want to talk about this relationship between this and post-war historical, going forward, the post-war historical memory in Japan. I mean, as you know, we talked about it in the past, I'm working now with Shumei Huang in National Taiwan University on this particular case, which for me is very peculiar, of right-wing Japanese groups working together with indigenous people to build Shinto shrines in Couscous, in the area of Couscous, by the tribe that was involved in the Mudan incident. And there's kind of a strange alignment between it, some indigenous and some right-wing Japanese, which seems peculiar to me. So how do we get here? I mean, and how does the Mushi incident fit into it?
Well, I think this is an interesting case. My understanding of the shrine in Couscous is that it was built in 2015, if I'm not mistaken, with a large amount of foreign capital, Japanese capital, through networks established through the Lee Donghui kind of Taiwan Japanese Friendship Association. So there's this context. I believe the original shrine wasn't built until the late 30s. I think it was destroyed in 46. And so it was dormant. And so here we see one of many cases where people in Japan can think about the relationship to Taiwan as validating the empire, because there is a strong discourse in Japan about Taiwanese continued love of Japan. And of course, this is very partial view of history. But to get to your case, we could go just down the road on Highway 199 to the Stone Gate Memorial Complex, which is also to the Mudan incident. And we could go to the Stone Gate Battlefield. And there's been a Shinto shrine there that's been up since the 1920s. It's still there. And the grave marker that Saigo Tsugumichi built, it's been there since 1874. And it's a different kind of memorial complex because Okinawan memory activists have linked up with Taiwanese local boosters to celebrate a relationship between Ryukyu and southern Taiwan that is subnational. And it's a way of trying to commemorate the 54 Ryukyuans, but also the Taiwanese that died in the 1874 war against Japan, but it's not necessarily anti-colonial. And so the way I would understand this might be a little different. If I think about the Couscous Shrine, I think about Couscous as a locality that is in sort of cooperation, but also in competition with Mudan and with Sherman and Dongbu, and there's politics within the Paiwanese group in Taiwan, and there are different groups in Japan and in Okinawa that have different kinds of relationships to these particular places. So I think one way to understand the possible alignment between right-wing Japanese nationalism and indigenous participation in shrine construction is to not think about indigenous peoples in Taiwan as people that might have a sort of anti-colonial consciousness prima facie. They would have many kinds of local concerns that aren't involved in that larger kind of anti-colonial stance.
Yeah, of course. And me even using the term indigenous as something that talks about as one group is wrong in a way, because there's so many different groups within this big umbrella term called indigenous, and there's difference between couscous and musha, and right. So where does musha fit into it? The historical memory of musha. I mean, I'm thinking about the movie mostly here that is very particular telling of the musha incident, and how does it fit in indigenous? Maybe now there was just an election in Taiwan. How does it fit in general Taiwanese memory?
So I think the Musha Rebellion, Michael Berry has written about this in an excellent book called A History of Trauma, A History of Pain. And, you know, in Taiwan, the Musha Rebellion is first sort of reimagined as an anti-colonial movement that all Taiwanese can celebrate. And then as the filmmaker who produced the blockbuster that most people know The Rebellion by got further involved, it seemed to be more of an expression of indigenous religiosity, a lost sacred mission to obtain heads, and an attempt to look at this rebellion and refract it through sort of indigenous mentality. But then the problem becomes the allies of the Japanese Empire that fought against Monoru Dao, their stories aren't represented in the movie. And the fact that almost all indigenous Taiwanese people today are Christians and would be uncomfortable embracing headhunting as a spiritual activity has to figure into the equation. So in Taiwan, there's going to be a complicated relationship to Musha, because many Taiwanese fought on the side of the Japanese against Monoru Dao. So that is a very painful and fraught episode in colonial memory. But I think in Japan, there is a wave of nostalgia for Japanese colonialism, and people would rather watch maybe the film Kano about the indigenous baseball team that did well instead of watch this. But if you're a progressive anti-colonial Japanese person, you're going to like this film, because it's pretty much, and it's anti-colonial in tenor and in message.
Yeah, and again, there's so much more to talk to, but we're pushing towards the 1 hour mark. So I have one more question about the book, and then I want to wrap up asking what you're doing now. I want to ask about the archival work you did, because it's quite amazing. I mean, at the end of the book, you found Kondo's lost package slip from the Taiwan mail. And there's so many different sources you use in so many languages. Can you tell me more about this aspect of the work? I mean, what was the archival basis for this book?
So the big, to keep this short and to get on the main point, the big breakthrough for Taiwan studies is the digitization of the whole manuscript collection of the Taiwan government general. And not only has it been completely digitized, it is now accessible from the United States online. It's not completely easy to use, but it's a lot easier than what I had when I started in 1995 on this project, where things were photostats and copies or edited collections that are printed and bound and transcribed, and so much material gets lost. So in this day and age, the complete corpus of the Taiwan government general's records are available online. If you can read them, if you don't mind reading this scribbly handwritten documentation, some of it's printed, some of it's not. There's all kinds of documents. That's a vast advance. And the other thing is that indigenous peoples have been funded by the Taiwanese government to do oral histories, and those are published in Chinese. And I was able to, you can get those in the library now, and those are really wonderful supplements to the documentary record that is now available. And I didn't have any of this when I started, and without that kind of documentation, I would just be translating his memoir. Instead, this book is me arguing with the memoir and pushing back against it and yet acknowledging where it's valuable. And this is where history is different than literary studies or anthropology. I'm not just going to say, here's what Kondo said. It might be right. It might be wrong. I'm trying to say, this is where I think he got it right. And this is where I think he got it wrong. And I think it matters. I think we should try to do that. And I hope the documentary record allowed me to make an honest attempt at that.
Yeah, and it's good that we finished with Kondo, because he's such a fascinating figure, as historical figure also. He is such a complex and problematic figure. It's just so wonderful to have this whole book about him. So again, I can talk for much more about so many different aspects here, but I want to just stop and ask you now, what are you doing next? What's your next project?
Right now, I'm looking at Japanese military awards, both monetary bonuses and decorations in wars, large and small. And I'm trying to understand Japanese warfare and military history as it would encompass counterinsurgency wars in the colonies, the more well-known wars, and how it brings in non-Japanese actors as combatants, as a way to think about Japanese imperial military ideology, but through a pretty focused attention to the material and the bureaucracy of apportioning merit and award and honor on soldiers, sailors, porters, engineers, auxiliaries. It was a vast system. I believe it's understudied, and I believe I'll be working on this project for a good long time. So thank you for asking that question.
Yeah, and I should mention you have an article that came out 2 years ago, I guess, in Japan Focus, Asia-Pacific Japan Focus, called Japan's Forever War. Was it 2 years ago?
Yeah, I think Japan's Forever War, it's already been 2 years, the time flies.
So it's a wonderful, and I use it for teaching, and because connects so much to American experience, and Forever comes from American experience. So another parallel here. So again, a lot to talk about, but I think our time is more or less up. I want to thank you for coming today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you. And I really enjoyed it. And I hope I can see you here again soon.
All right. Well, thanks. Don't forget, the book is online for PDF copy. Thank you.